Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Claudio and Jorelina from Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. I am super excited to jump into this conversation, learn more about Ethiopian wolves and what's going on in the world. I would love for you to tell our listeners a bit about yourselves. What is so special about the Ethiopian wolf? And what brought you, Claudio, to co-found EWCP?
What is not special about the Horn of Africa, where our work is based, I would say. And even more to the point, how did I end up there? I'm currently a professor of conservation biology at the University of Oxford in the UK, but I hail from the Argentine Pampas. And somewhere in between, I found myself traveling and working in Africa, and a job opportunity took me to Ethiopia. That was back in 1987, and that's when I met the wolves. And all these years later, we're still working very hard there to try to protect them and the special habitat they live in.
Well, myself, I can say that the Ethiopian wolves are unique, and probably many of the listeners haven't heard about them. And they are at the top of the highlands in Ethiopia. They are only found there. They are colorful, beautiful. They live in families. And you will not find them in your zoos. They are only in the wild. And there are many remarkable things about them. So today, I hope we will be sharing more of these beautiful things with you.
What started as a straightforward science program, I was recruited to study the wolves and trying to figure out what the needs were. It grew into a conservation program, and there's a natural transition in science that Perfect. You become engaged with the subject matter, and then you develop a sense of responsibility. And I think that's how Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program, EWCP, grew organically from what was originally a doctoral study.
How would you summarize what your mission and your methodology is to someone who's new to your work?
It became apparent that these animals needed help, and not just for themselves. I mean, you could argue many reasons why we should protect species, but it's equally important to find a connection between species conservation and protecting functioning ecosystems. And with Ethiopian wolves, like with many other flagship species, it's possible to establish that connection. So by delivering conservation action that can protect a particular population of a given species, you're also enabling the conservation and the functioning of those very same ecosystems. So you use the wolf, in this case, to promote the Afro-Alpine ecosystem that is vital, not just for wildlife, but for people living around those highlands. I would say millions of people benefit from the water that falls and is preserve in the roof of Africa, in the Horn of Africa. So people as far as Somaliland, South Sudan, Eritrea are benefiting from the water that flows out of central Ethiopia. And the wolves, in a way, are the guardians of that resource.
Incredible. You've mentioned there the Horn of Africa and these Afro-Alpine habitat. How would you describe what this environment that the Ethiopians live in? How can someone visualize this?
Well, I think that if those among you that have been in highlands, I think you could visualize it, because when you go up in the mountains, the landscapes resemble each other. So this is above the tree line, and it's dominated by grasslands and moorlands. It's an open habitat with some crazy plants like giant lobelias and beautiful meadows. So it's very green, and then it's very dry in the summer. And the landscape is dramatic. Mountains, volcanoes, valleys. So I know if you are from Scotland, you maybe can relate to these landscapes. And me coming from Argentina, like Claudio, I work also in the high Andes, And then when I up there in the mountains, I say, well, this is so similar. So it's just vast and pure and tranquil.
I like to think of the highlands as the roof of Africa. And the roof of Africa, more often than not, is covered by cloud. So it's an island in the clouds, island in the air. You're standing there, and there is no real sense of where the plateau ends and the void begins. So it's a very special airy feeling. And
yes,
right from there, when you're sucking that in, Wolf walks in the beautiful red, black and white coats, and you just kind of marvel and love that in silence.
Love that. What a beautiful description. A little island in the sky. Stunning. Yeah. Off the back of that, as we know, global climates are changing rapidly. And as you just mentioned there, it is an island in the sky. How is climate change affecting these Ethiopian wolf habitats in these Afro-Alpine highlands? And what steps is EWCP taking to address these impacts?
Yes, as probably most of you must be aware of, the highlands are particularly vulnerable to climate change because as the weather, the climate warms up, the vegetation can encroach higher up, and you might be losing these species that are trapped in these islands in the sky. It is also very difficult to measure really climate change and to be able to say, oh, this is climate change. This is driven by climate change. But there is this slow movement towards the higher elevations. And in Ethiopia, the way we see it more clearly is because the agriculture, because these communities depend on agriculture in a small plots, they grow barley, potatoes. As the climate warmer, they can cultivate the land higher and higher up. So this is like a frontier of the agriculture that creeps encroaching up. And as the land is taken for agriculture, it's taken away from the wolves and those many other animals and plants. So really is translated into habitat loss. So what we do, I mean, it's difficult to think of ways to stop such a big thing. Sometimes the problems are very big, too big for a conservation program to address. But the way we're doing, and I think we'll talk more about this later, is making the use of these resources in the highlands more sustainable. So, you know, preserving this water, preserving these grasses. So when it's a drought, when it's a bad year, there will be these additional resources for people, for livestock. So like creating these cushions. So when the climate is particularly bad, there will be some flexibility, some adaptability in the communities.
And we are talking here about very small numbers. There are less than 500 Ethiopian wolves left on Earth. And one of the main reasons there are so few of them is because these enclaves, mountain enclaves where they're found, they're very small. And they're getting ever smaller.
It's such a shame, isn't it, to know that they have such small numbers left on the world. You just mentioned there the growth of agriculture slowly driving upward into the highlands. What beyond that? What are other compound effects that this is having on their habitats and the environment that they interact in?
Yes, we know that many of these processes are relatively slow for our human clock. And things are changing. We can measure and predict that things are changing. But there are some other threats that affect wildlife more rapidly. And the most immediate and present danger to the wolves doesn't come from global warming, but it comes from coexistence with people. Although there is a very good rapport between the pastoralists that live up in the highlands and the wolves, with people and the livestock, domestic dogs also come into the highlands. And they are unknowingly bringing diseases that affect the wolves. So we became aware back in the late 80s that rabies could be transmitted from domestic dogs across to the wolves. And whenever an outbreak struck, the impact could be really deadly. I think that is the single most important reason why we established the Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program in 1995. We felt we had to do something. And the obvious thing for us to do was to work with local people to vaccinate the dogs, to try to prevent the rabies virus jumping across to the wild relatives. And the beauty of this, unknowingly to us at the time, was that by engaging with people and vaccinating their dogs, you were having a triple impact there. You were helping the wolves, you were also protecting dogs, and you were helping people. The economy relies on the livestock. And if a cow dies of rabies, because it's not so commonly known, but livestock will also be affected of rabies. And as they lose their animals, they are losing money, their children and the shepherds are also exposed to being attacked by a domestic dog. So this One Health approach that we started in the 90s, and we wasn't even called One Health then, it delivers this magic bullet that impacts positively people, their livelihoods, and wildlife alike. And that was an entry point for us to be welcomed by the local communities. So rather than being perceived as outsiders, foreigners that are telling people what to do and how to go about protecting their environment, they welcome us. There was some reluctance about vaccination first, because, you know, people not always makes the connection between a vaccine and its positive impacts. But once they realized that their animals were surviving better, that there were no cases of rabies that affecting people, and that that was linked somehow to the wolves, then our program became really popular. And we've been doing One Health ever since.
Incredible. And I am super excited to dive into that just after we hear from our first station sponsor, and we'll be back soon.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Claudio and Jorgelina from Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program. We just left off as they described the journey that it's taken from the discovery of the conservation program and their work with the local community that has been integrated from the establishment of the conservation program. Now, we just left off talking about what's now called the One Health approach. I am really interested to know how EWCP is working with people on the ground. I was reading up about your wolf ambassadors and monitoring teams. How are they helping wolf populations? And how does this then lead into the wider One Health approach?
Yes, the heart of the conservation program are the wolf monitors and more recently the wolf ambassadors that form this team that is out in the mountains looking for the wolves almost every day. And this is seems like an old-fashioned way with all the technology we have around, but really, if you care about the Ethiopian wolves and you want to know what's happening, you go out in the mountains at daytime and you can find the families together or maybe the wolves foraging alone. And it's this continuous presence that makes it possible to understand their lives, their problems, and crucially, to react when the diseases pass from the domestic dogs to the wolves. Because once an animal is infected by rabies or canine distemper, which is another virus, many of them will die. So this team of monitors and wolf ambassadors are the first line in detecting diseases in the system. And from there on, the program can intervene and support to stop the disease spreading through vaccinations, for example. So is their continuous presence there in the field that really provide the most important information? Because also from the wolves, we learn what to do, when to do it, how families drive, what happens when some wolves die. And I think that the key point about the wolf monitors and the wolf ambassadors is that they are from their local communities. So they grew in the mountains, they belong there. And so really the communication between the project, if you want, and the communities is through them. And I think we can say that the communities own the program in a way. And a good example of this is whenever a domestic dog has rabies in one of the villages near the mountains or someone sees an Ethiopian wolf, they will call immediately to the team. And we call this.
Yeah. How did you guys establish that rapport with the local communities? How did you build up that sense of community ownership with your program, that they wanted to participate, that they wanted to join monitoring teams, that they now call you when these issues arise? How did that become established.
I think that, Claudio, you could link that with how we just started all, really, because that doesn't happen from one day to the other. That takes a lot of time.
It's about persistence and not going away, because typically most development work or conservation work involves very enthusiastic teams that inject lots of funds and resources into a place, and then 1, 2, 3 years later they walk away and people are left empty-handed, and sometimes they feel betrayed. And I think our success came as a result of persistence. Just to give you an example, Idris Ebu was the first field assistant in my program. We met in 1987. He was a very young man in his teens. Today, he's the program manager. So he's been working with us for nearly 40 years. And he became very successful and very well respected by the community. And every member of the staff of EWCP, about 50 of them, will have a comparable story to tell. So the program is interweaved with the families and with the villages where we work. So there is not just an environmental tale, but there is also a concrete economy around conservation that should not be disregarded, because it's very important. Those resources that come in, the training that comes in, the opportunities that people can access are what binds us together and in a way deliver success.
That is absolutely incredible. I love your, it was very vivid what you just described there. So you've mentioned here the growth of the One Health approach and how you guys have established these links with the community, these ambassadors, these wolf monitoring teams, and the interconnectedness between the local community groups and your organization. I want to know, as you've mentioned that you've been working on these programs for nearly 40 years, how has technology changed in the way that it supports your work? Technology most recently has adapted and grown so much, as particularly with the use of AI, multiple NGOs that I've spoken to are starting to integrate that into their work. How is technology supporting Ethiopian wolf conservation, and when it comes to things like disease monitoring for rabies in remote areas?
Yeah, it's interesting that technology has revolutionized science in particular. So in our case, we are embracing technology, and many projects are. The core is still, you know, the fact that you are in the field and you're observing the wolves, finding the same families, checking if they are having puppies, really, it's not something that technology can replace. And I think that we will always maintain that as the core of our work. But of course, there are so many things that can help us, technologies that can help us. So one of the first ways we embrace technology was with the production of an app. So we collect data on a table, a customized app. So now the thousands of wolf sightings that we collect every year can easily be stored and shared with other people. So that makes it a lot much easier to communicate. Mm-hmm. And camera traps. Camera traps are fascinating. We are using them around the dens, so we are starting to understand a little bit more what threats may be that they may be exposed to, and what is the fate of the puppies.
On that note, I just wanted to interject real quick. So as you mentioned, there was the circa 500 Ethiopian wolves that remain, correct? So do you guys have tracking and monitoring of all of these 500, or the majority of this number?
Yes, we are not tracking the 500 of them, but we are tracking many of them. You imagine these islands in the skies that we were describing. So there is a big, big one. It's called the Bale Mountains. So around 300 wolves, so more than half of the world population lives there. And there may be around 50 packs, and we monitor around 30 of them. For the ones we really know, we know everything, and we will know how many adult males there are, adult females, sub-adults, how the pups are doing. And the rest we visit less regularly. And in other populations, in other mountains, we have teams as well. So we will know maybe another 5 packs in the Simien Mountains up in North Ethiopia, and another 5 in another population, and another 5 in another population. The focal packs really give you data that you need to understand the populations and to inform the conservation. But they are really good indicators of the health of that population as well. And so it is a mixture, and the technology help, particularly where we cannot reach, where we cannot have all these, so many wolf monitors doing this spectacular work. So satellite collars, for example, are really now bringing us information about how wolves go about when the habitat is not so good in quality, and maybe there are more disturbances around them. So really, it's very exciting when you can see a map and see what the wolf was doing today. There is an animal that is exploring. We think it's going to disperse. It's so difficult to know when wolves are dispersing, why, how they do it. So really, I think also excites young people, and people in the field are excited when you have suddenly a camera trap in your hands and then you put it there, you see the camera. So it really brings people into conservation, and people that are away from the mountains, they can see photos and videos, and I think it's crucial also in that regard.
For listeners who are inspired to help, what actionable steps can they take to support the Ethiopian wolf conservation through EWCP?
I can think of at least two or three ways in which people can get more involved. But I will stress something that from what Jorge Linares just said, that of course we think of individual animals and you develop that engagement and empathy for individual. But I think the real strength of Ethiopian wolves is life as a pack. They are families. They are very social, reliant on each other. They are aware and depending on each other. And I think that's what makes the connection with human beings as well. We are also a pack species. We are a very social species. And we can empathize with that, with those social interactions. So I think that's the real strength of these wolves. So when I talk about them, I tend to think about, oh, that is the
Tuma
pack. That is... Yeah. The BBC pack, that is the quarry pack. So I'm just thinking of them as families and what they do and how they come and go. But as to how the human pack might engage with the wolf pack, the first thing I would say is through awareness that, you know, particularly in the West, we think of Africa and we are quite reductionist about, oh, Africa, rolling plains, megafauna, and so on. But Africa is an incredibly diverse continent with wonderful biomes wherever you look. And the Afro-Alpine is a very special one. It's not the only place. But most people are not aware of that. So becoming more informed or better informed about how Africa differs from country to country, from biome to biome, from faunal assemblages to faunal assemblages. And that diversity is happening right across. The human diversity in Africa is larger than the rest of the world combined together, because it's our home. Humans, you know, first appear in Africa and from there conquer the rest of the world. And with wildlife and with nature, with the plants and species and so on, that diversity is also there. So I get to know about this diversity, engage with it, embrace diversity and read about it, watch more about it. And in doing that, inform others, you know, share with your loved ones, with your friends, with your colleagues, you know.
You be the student and the educator.
You know, what you learn about it. And in doing that, you'll be helping us. You'll be helping the wolves as well. And of course, there are many channels by which you can learn very specific things about the wolves through our website, ethiopianwolf.org, but also through our social channels.
And they'll be learning stuff here today as well.
Of course. And thank you for that. So just those snippets of exciting stories. And when there is the anecdote that involves a particular person or involves a particular animal, then it's a storytelling. It becomes more relevant. It's not just a fact, but it's something else. There is a story behind. And third, and equally important, we live in the UK. We are a wealthy nation, although we are not always thinking that way. And there are many people that are fortunate to live very comfortable lives. The people that live hand in hand with wildlife in places like the Horn of Africa don't have the access to the same resources as we do. So if you are inclined to help wildlife and to help function in ecosystems in Africa, do your bit by making a small donation. And we have channels for that as well. Every donation, however small, it matters, and it's going to impact a wolf, who is going to impact a member of the community one way or another.
Very well said. Now, we've spoken a lot about community, and we've spoken most recently about technology as well. How is EWCP blending traditional knowledge with modern conservation practices. How are you guys listening with the community and integrating their knowledge of their landscapes, the way that they interact with the animals, or their historical ancestral knowledge, towards working towards the future of restoring populations, really restoring these habitats, looking after the longevity of these regions?
So I think that there is a particularly good example in the work the Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program is doing. It's a project that we called Biodiversity-Friendly Futures. And it's about thinking what is the future for the wolves and the people in these habitats. And from the time I first went to Ethiopia and I was visiting these mountains, you observe habitat degradation sometimes. There is too much grazing. Sometimes you see erosion. But I could also observe in some areas that people were growing this native grass that grows also in the mountains that is very important for their livelihoods. It's called wasa. And I could see also beautiful erica forests that suddenly were disappearing. So I think through these observations, we started with a team in the northern part of Ethiopia to rescue these traditions. What is the value of the grass? It's really important because also has a monetary value, but there are traditional ways to grow this plant, as there are traditional ways to produce honey from the highlands. So we are working together, and we bring support, external support, to make these alternative livelihoods for the people happen. But really, the knowledge is there and is coming out from the communities, which sometimes actually they want to embrace technology as well. So the traditional beehive, it has worked, but a modern beehive really is a lot more productive. So we are combining these technologies, and sometimes it's about bringing knowledge, training for the farmers to combine the different beehives. And beautiful to see, because in the process, the communities use their traditional ways of organizing around helping each other, creating committees and cooperatives so that they help each other when it's the planting time and the harvest time for this wasa, which they sell in the market. So I think there is this beautiful tradition in Ethiopia related to the mountains that with a little bit of help can really propagate more and help people in their day-to-day lives, which actually sometimes is about having some income, really. That makes a big difference to these communities. And so we love this so much that we are moving into community-led monitoring. How are these grasslands that are restored doing? Is the diversity coming back? Are the wolves coming back? Guys, what do you want to measure in your community conservation area? So we are mixing, listening to this traditional knowledge. There's so much of it. And they are welcoming, and they want what we bring from modern approaches or science.
What are your hopes from this information? Where do you hope to expand this model outwards?
Well, my hope is, and I've been working on this for 10 years now, and it's scaling up. Now the people want the community to say, oh, look, this is so good. We could restore our degraded land and plant wasa. So we are moving into peer-to-peer training. Really, this is something that doesn't require us in the long term. So it's something that could scale up. And the information that comes from this collaborative monitoring goes into the councils, where the communities take decisions about the use of their natural resources. So having information can really make a difference for how they evolve into managing their resources, but also into co-managing with governments, because governments sometimes are a bit far away from what's happening on the ground. So what I hope is that this will be sustainable, and that really we won't need to be there anymore.
Well, it sounds incredible. It sounds like such a restorative program, if it goes well and continues to succeed. Now, we've spoken much about the Horn of Africa in general and the wider communities around the Afro-Alpine habitats. I really want to kind of jump into here is tourism in these regions. How integrated or how affected is the Ethiopian wolf's habitat? How affected is it by tourism? And do you guys have to ensure that tourism and livestock grazing both benefits the local economies whilst preventing transmissions? And like, I'm trying to figure out how it all integrates in these areas.
Tourism is undeveloped in Ethiopia, and although it can provide some positive impacts on wildlife conservation, is not the answer for everything. And there is a background that has prevented tourism to become a significant industry in Ethiopia. And thus, the Ethiopians' history, recent history of civil unrest and war, and even going further back, famine. And people tend to make a negative connection.
Connotation, yeah.
And missing the point that it's a vibrant society nowadays and it has wonderful places to visit. Most of the tourism has been targeted to cultural sites, which are many and beautiful. And what we see, wildlife tourism can, in a way, get a ride on the more traditional tourism. And there are places where it's possible to go trekking and to have amazing wildlife experiences, but still not at the level where it could have a significant impact on the economy yet.
So when it comes to tourism in general, do you feel like there is a then lack of funding associated with the money that goes towards Ethiopia because there isn't that connection with tourism?
But tourism and how money kind of reaches the communities that live in the areas where the tourists visit, it's always been a challenge. And this is not specific to Ethiopia, but worldwide. I think getting the model right and ensuring that the operators are locally based, that the funds reach those communities and that there is a clear connection. So you can get a job and you can benefit from those visitors that come to your village and come to your mountain. So there is a lot that can be done there. So at the high end level is how do we attract the customers to come and visit? And lower down is how we ensure that those benefits that cascade down.
And in what ways do you envision that happening?
There has been very good initiatives, particularly in community conservation areas in the mountains for the communities to benefit from tourism. And I think that the model was right. The problem is that there's not enough tourism coming. And to be honest, at the moment, in half of the wolf habitat is really a very risky place to be. So there's fight. I think the model in the future, I would like to see a model that is community-led, like these examples that we have experienced in the past, and one that is respectful with nature while also benefiting the communities. But really, that depends on also some higher level predisposition to that. And I think in the world of conservation, we are learning that the grassroots initiatives and the ones that really not just benefit community, but are led by them, are the ones that work. So yes. I have hope that
it has to be done right.
Yeah, and that message keeps being heard out and loud, and that will be the road for tourism in Ethiopia as well.
Amazing. We all have hope here. And on that note, we're going to be right back after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Claudio and Jorgelina from Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program. We just left off talking about the impacts of tourism or lack thereof in Ethiopia and how it's affecting both the conservation programs, local communities, and funding. Now, Claudio, just before the break there, we spoke about perceptions of Ethiopia in regard to famine, economic unrest, and those all having knock-on effects when it comes to both tourism and, I'm assuming, conservation work within the areas. Now, what common myths or misunderstandings are still persisting, and how can we reshape public perception not only to benefit Ethiopia, their local communities, but also to benefit conservation programs like yours?
At the societal level, Ethiopia has always been focusing on bettering the livelihood of the people. So getting better education, access to work, and so on. And typically in that model, the environment tend to be left behind. So people say, let's develop our agriculture, let's get more productive, let's put food on the tables, let's ensure that there is education. And I think now there is a perception that we cannot deliver progress or deliver human development without taking care of the environment. So I think that is coming through. But there's still, there was that kind of perception of the old model that, okay, we set areas aside for wildlife. People are here and wildlife are there. So there was a disconnect. And now we're increasingly talking about community conservation areas, ways of using resources sustainably so that people can continue to exist and hopefully coexist hand in hand with wildlife. So I would say that lack of knowledge or misalignment that we once had is beginning to heal and is beginning to be redressed. But of course, the pressures on the environment are huge. We have more and larger human population worldwide than ever before, and it continues to grow. And every family aspires to improve their lot. We all want to do better, so the pressures on the resources continue to increase. So rather than say, no, we can't access resources, let's say, let's access resources in a sustainable manner. Let's find ways in which we can continue to function and improve our lot. And it might involve protecting that precious water that runs down the slopes to benefit millions of people. Or it might be a wiser use of resources, such as Jorge Lina was suggesting. We can find clever ways of increasing the production of some of those resources and put them to good use, generate cash that can help these subsistence communities and so on. So there are plenty of micro solutions, if you wish. And I think in diversity is where the value really lies. So there isn't a single solution that fits all. But there are lots of small things that can be done to improve everyone's lot.
I'd love to pick up on a key of what you just mentioned there with everyone wanting this improvement for both their families, their lives, and both their economic standing, for example, in Ethiopia. With your guys' work with these communities, and we've mentioned obviously your One Health program, and you've got the work of the membership communities working in integration with your conservation program. Are there any special stories, let's say, of a community member or even a wider wolf pack that they've worked with that's really embodies what your One Health conservation approach matters so much?
Yes, I think I have a couple of stories. Tarura, maybe, or Tarulve? There is this particular wolf. We call her Tarura too because, you know, scientists, we give codes and numbers. And she's a female and that is 15 years old. And I think her story really exemplifies how the One Health approach operates in by looking just at one individual. So this is an animal that lives in the Valley Mountains, and it was the only female that survived a big rabies episodic in the Valley Mountains. And that was around 2009. So this wolf was vaccinated in 2011 and then two more times. So over this time of all these years, she was a dominant female in that pack, and she survived four other episodics because she was protected, which is also an interesting point, because even though we might try as hard as we can to eradicate a disease, it never disappears from the environment, particularly when there are so many domestic dogs. So she did survive four episodics and produce 51 pups in all her life. And three of her children, daughters or sons, went out to create three different packs with another 10 liters. So, you know, she is a super mom. And I think sometimes in conservation helps to have this individual that in which you can merge success in a way. And she really was probably the animal that contributed most to the recovery of the valley population from diseases. And that comes, Superman comes from the work of the veterinary team vaccinating dogs every day, and the veterinary team vaccinating Ethiopian wolves or delivering oral vaccines. So I like that story. And she's a grandma now.
Yes, no, it's an incredible story, and a story of resilience as well, which I love. Now, you've been working with Ethiopian wolves and these communities for, like we've mentioned many times, they're 40 years now. What, over that course of time, has you found as unexpected discoveries about their behavior or ecology? What has surprised you most in your work?
There are plenty of stories, but I'm going to go back to the very beginning, where the first wolf I really got to know is a young female called Flora. At the time, I was giving names of Roman and Greek gods and goddesses to these animals. So Flora was this young female that was very keen, and she was, as social wolves do, it was helping her mother raise her pups. So you have a very diligent young sister, older sister, that will be there attending to the younger siblings. But after doing that a couple of years, she got pushed out of her range by her mother. So she kind of wandered as a floater, kind of trying to figure out whether there was a future for her making her own family somewhere. But eventually she came back, and she had been pregnant and had lost her own pups and joined her mother instead and started allosuckling. That is a technical term to wet nurse someone else's pups. So we have this situation in which we had two mums providing nourishment to these young pups. And of course, with twice as much milk, these guys grew very healthily and very rapidly. And what I thought at the time, that it was a very unique circumstance, it turned up to be pretty common in Ethiopian wolves. So it's an evolutionary strategy that if you don't have a home range, if you don't have a territory where you can lord and have your own family, the next best option for you is to go and help your mom raise your younger brothers and sisters.
So that really leads into what you said earlier with that pack, the pack mentality, in the sense of being like, well, no, this is my community too. I should be nursing. Yes,
indeed. You know, technically, in ecological terms, yes, we know the reasons why we do that, because it brings inclusive fitness, so your genes are more likely to be passed on to next generations. So I'm not able to have my own children for now, but I'm going to help my mom or my sister or my auntie raise their own children, and I'm going to be better off for that. So I think that was the very first lesson that I learned from the wolves.
I guess off the back of that, if you could ask an Ethiopian wolf one question, what would you ask them? What would you want to know if they could respond to you and tell you something?
Okay, there are so many questions, but I'm going to be...
You've only got one. You can only ask them one question.
Can we ask one each?
Yes, one each. Go on.
I'm going to bring an evolutionary perspective. About 20 million years ago, Africa was an island. It was separated from the rest of the world. There was the Tethys Sea separating them, and therefore transit of animals back and forth, or plants, was impossible. The Tethys Sea closed down, and then these land corridors became available, and there were many animal and plant species that took that opportunity to escape from what it was a very dry, arid environment in the Middle East and move into Africa. So I wish I was on the shoulder of one of those wolves, figuring out the way of how to move into Africa and finding these amazing mountains and making a living there.
So it's not that you want to ask them a question, it's you want to experience that element as a wolf. I love that. Okay.
Indeed.
Yes.
So maybe then I can ask a question if I could. I would ask the wolf, if you have to leave this island, because some of them, they have to leave the population and find another place, where do you go? I mean, how do you find your way? Are you following the higher land? I want to know, because I think I want to build corridors that will keep these populations connected.
Okay, I see.
Mystery. What drives you? Where do you go? So I will ask that, and I will take notes.
It's kind of part of our human connectedness. We want to understand their drive. We want to be like, why are you going this way? What is it that's pulling you there? I love that. Oh, well, guys, we've had a beautiful chat so far. We are coming near to the end of our conversation here today. So I would love to know, what is one key takeaway you want listeners to remember about, like I just mentioned, the interconnection between humans and wildlife and ecosystem health, particularly in related to the Ethiopian highland?
Well, I think that you just said it, and I think all our conversation was about all these different aspects that make people's lives and nature and wildlife, and is the interconnectedness. So when you think about the Ethiopian wolf, or if you're helping Ethiopian wolf and Ethiopian wolf conservation, that means helping people, helping the water resources for millions of people, helping people at the edge of survival. And it is all interconnected. And actually, if you look out your window in your garden or in your park, you can also feel the same and understand the same, that everything is interconnected. So I hope that the story of the Ethiopian wolves bring this lesson and these thoughts to you, and that also you can help our program by also implement it in your everyday life.
Well, Thank you, guys. I have learned so much today as well. And I would love to know where people can learn more about EWCP and maybe what your final message of hope for wildlife conservation in Ethiopia is.
There is a lot of information online, but I will encourage people to look specifically at our site, ethiopianwolf.org, or look at our social media. If you look for Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program or Ethiopian Wolves, you will find us. But I think the message of hope is that the future lies with our younger generations. We want our children and the children to come to re-engage with nature, to turn and look around the wondrous marvels of nature around us, because we have a lot to learn from it and we depend on it ultimately. So if we can regenerate or cultivate that link with nature, then I'm sure that all will be in a better place.
Beautiful. Well, thank you everyone for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love you to visit our website, OurAlteredWorld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at FlunkingMonkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.